This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time. Okay, Kate, this week we are talking about research.
Excellent. Love it.
Now, you have far more of a background in this than I do, so I think this episode is going to feel a bit like me quizzing you, but it's something I'm considering doing.
I cannot believe I saw this in the notes and I was like, what do you mean she's considering doing?
Tell us any more than that little droplet of joy?
Story concept for my third novel, and I can't decide, and there's a good reason for each scenario, whether I should set it weirdly in Florida in the 1950s or in Australia in the current day. But the idea of research.
Yeah.
Like, I have never, ever considered doing anything that required research, unless it was nonfiction.
The idea of sinking into Florida in the 1950s right now is so joyous that I would just say go for that option just because that's way more fun than contemporary Australia right now.
That's true. Well, it would be contemporary Australia but not mid-pandemic.
Yeah.
No one write a book about a pandemic. Like, no. Does this need to be said?
But from here on in, you're going to have to include it, right? So I suspect there's going to be a bit of a throwback to the good old historical fiction. Who wants to deal with the pandemic?
That's right. Everything will be set in 2019 or 2025.
Really, Catherine Collette. You heard it here first, people.
So we shall see. We shall see. But let me pick your research brain. We'll talk about skylarking. We want to keep the powder dry on the motherboard.
Keep the powder dry. Yeah.
Okay. So skylarking, obviously based on a true story set in the 1800s.
Yeah.
1800s.
1880s.
1880s. So how did you feel about writing a story that was set in the past? Exciting, daunting?
Well, yeah. Exciting and daunting both. But see, the beauty of back then is I didn't know what I was doing. I thought that I had to do the research, whereas now the same process. I do know what I'm doing. It's far more daunting. So back then I was just doing it because that's when the true story was. Yeah. And I was a grade A nerd who wanted to make sure that I had all my facts straight because I worked at the State Library and that's what people doing research had to do, get everything right, which I still believe. But then I was, propelled by that kind of force.
Do you think that's more of that truth to research is more of a nonfiction thing? Retrospectively, looking back, do you think it's more important? Obviously, you need to have truth in setting a historical novel in a place that makes it feel real. But do you think that the library, having worked in a library, that the emphasis that had on research was more about uncovering truthful stories of the past, not so much fiction?
I think now what I know is that there are a bazillion different approaches to it from a fiction perspective. So I'm not as worried about making sure all the facts are perfectly right, but I'm more worried about things like, do I take the approach of doing all the research first, immersing myself in the research, then finishing the research period and starting the writing?
Yep.
Or do I do like Toni Jordan has talked about in her approach, I know with 9 days, I'm not sure if she's done it with the other ones, writing first, working out where the gaps are, then going back and retrospectively filling it with the research. Like, again, there's no right answer. It has to be, I suppose, what works for you and for the project. But what all those questions do is mean that you can spend a lot of time thinking about what is the correct approach to this creative project instead of just starting the bloody creative project is what I found.
There's
I don't know if that
wonderfully question. Elaborate forms of procrastination. Isn't it? And I think research could definitely be one that you
really like. It really is. Most definitely.
So as a question, did you have to research much? I know you had to research some things for The Motherfold.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to research much?
I certainly I certainly hope what I have researched sits lightly on the page. Having said that, there's bloody reams and reams of research on all kinds of wacky stuff. And I think that was lots of fun in a way, because it's like these deep dives into weird things like surveillance technology and geology and sailing. Like, it's these specific deep dives.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're doing, you know, like what I'm working on now, it's like, okay, well, let's build this world like you might do with 1950s Florida. Like, let's build this 1930s Melbourne kind of world that has to be all encompassing. So I don't know if one, I think that it's daunting to build the whole world.
Yes.
It's fun to go down and go, okay, yes. I'm going to
That is very true. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
So what's the answer? Where are you starting this time around?
So this time around, you know what I really enjoyed and what I highly recommend people listen to? Fable Parrot talking.
I had the same thing to mention. Yeah.
Yeah. On the Parrot. And what was amazing is last night was the Stellar Awards. Congratulations to Jess Hill on her amazing win and to everyone on the shortlist. But Fable actually recorded her little speech in her studio with the wall behind her that she describes.
So we should talk to what Fable actually mentions in that.
Yeah. But I'm going to just turn you around, Catherine, so you can see this. See, I've started my own wall with photos and maps and things that I've got going. And my process at the moment is reading oral histories, a bunch of historical fiction kind of set around the time, a bunch of books about kind of similar themes, and I've got them all completely surrounding me here on the desk. And in the mornings when I'm getting my writing time, I'm kind of reading a little bit of one of the oral histories, and then I'm diving into, I've got both a journal document and a new Word document that I've just called Draft Zero open. And I'm kind of, if I feel like I've got a sense of a bit of a scene or something I want to write that might end up as actual composition other than me just talking about process, I'll put it into the Draft Zero, and it's just a big old mess at the moment. But that's the only way, that's the kind of way that I'm falling into it.
Yeah. So not whole scenes.
Not really. I've got a I suppose
this sounds very like Favell's
process.
Was, so the episode that we're referring to is Astrid Edwards of The Garret interviewed Favell Parrot on her, which one was it? There Was Still Love?
Still Love.
And it's a fabulous, really, really fabulous interview. And in it she talks about the writing process for that book, which is partly set in Poland in the war.
In Prague, in 1980s Prague, and earlier as well, 1950s Prague. And so
she had her writing studio essentially covered in photos from the era. It sounded phenomenal. And she had a cousin, I think, that she spoke to about, is this,
yeah,
would you have had schnitzel and potatoes?
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah,
I think that the interviews, I think having experts to speak to is something that I've now learned, is that they are such an incredible shortcut. And if you are in a position, which I luckily am because of the incredible team at the Living Museum of the West who I've been chatting to, who in fact just emailed me the other day and said, how are you going? We know you can't get over here. You know, do you need any help? And I could fire off these really specific questions that I've been recording as I go along, like, did anyone get meat rations from the abattoirs during the Depression? If they were working there, or, you know, like really specific questions that I wouldn't even know to ask if you weren't up to a certain spot in your research. So I think, I think having those experts that you can call on, and I did the same thing with the Mother Fault, where I could go, you know, if there was a storm and the weather was going like this, what would you need to do in this moment? Or if the engine broke in this particular way, how would you actually fix it? You know, you don't know that you need some of those bits of research until you're right there in the middle of a critical scene.
Yeah.
And they are the times, and I recommend this to students all the time when I'm working with them, is where I leave a big cross, 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 or highlighted, or question mark, question mark, question mark, and then just write on and then come back to it later.
So your third novel that you're working on will be based on a historic event. Or circumstance?
Historic place now. So characters all made up, but authentic to the time. But, set in a factory that did exist in
Melbourne's Ooh. West during the period of time. So,
this
yeah.
This
so,
what interests me, this merging of, so merging of truth but fictionalised, which I think a really good example of is the Kate Grenville book.
Yes, still sitting here.
Which you really still haven't read. Yeah, well, it comes out mid-year, something about leaves.
A roommate of leaves.
A roommate of leaves. So it's Elizabeth MacArthur, who was one of the first settlers, I suppose, is a shorthand way of describing her. But it's a fictionalised diary.
I think I love, and this is, again, referencing Liz Gilbert, but she just seems to have all the answers at the moment. In her Instagram talk about the research for City of Girls, she was saying she loved seeing how many times it's a Google question whether her characters were real in City of Girls, because she's like, that's exactly how it should feel. They're not real. She made them up entirely. But, you know, the world of 1940s theatre in New York was real.
Yeah.
And then so that was the setting, and then she made up everything else.
Which I think is so true of historical fiction, because people, I think, sometimes writing, particularly where there's memoir involved or family history involved, can want to stick so closely to the truth of the story, when in fact the thing you need to stick close to is the setting and the life of the place and the time.
Yeah.
Deviate.
From. And the story.
Yeah.
I've the story. I'll always remember Aviva telling me that in the middle of the writing of Skylarking, you know, Kate, step away from the research. You have to serve the story. And I think what I do know now about that whole research process, which I think we've talked about before, is if I had have known the real outcome of the true story of Kate and Harriet, I might never have written it. You know, it was actually too much.
Well,
and
you would have solved it. There's no,
yes,
like, this is what happened. It's no longer a question, you know. Mm. One of the things I remember from when you were writing Skylarking was that information can come from really funny places. And I feel like you had written quite a lot. You were fairly deep into it. And then you make this discovery by reading a kid's book about lighthouses. That was one of those things that was not obvious unless you really, really thought about it, but once pointed out seemed very obvious.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Kind of. I don't know whether it was
It was about that the lighthouse keeper would have to stay up at night, and so the dad of the family would be awake at night and be asleep in the day.
I'm pretty sure
that was it. Yeah.
Potentially that he was inside, and I think it's things like that that you go, like, I've read all the articles about there being three lighthouse keepers because this is what happens and this is what happens. But then you don't follow all the consequences.
Yeah. And so that has an echo, because then you're like, well, dad's not at breakfast.
Definitely.
He's, you know.
And I think and that's that idea, maybe. I don't know if this is what she's getting at, but that idea that I think I spoke about, that Charlotte talks about the thick description. That's when you have to build that whole world so that you've got that 3D look, so that when you go, you know, when you pan around to the parents' bedroom, you know what's in there during the day.
Yeah.
And I think there's lots of things that help with that. I think having pictures, I always get kids who are writing historical fiction to draw out maps, and I think that they're really useful because they often prompt you to go, okay, well, what is behind that fence? Or if I do go down the end of the street and I turn left, what will I see there? And I think those kinds of that's what that process was with looking at that children's book. It forced me to look at a different way at content I thought I already knew, and thus I realized where the gaps were. Maybe drawing it out, always really useful, I think.
Okay, storing information. I feel like this is always, you know, I think about this in the context of just even trying to understand what happens in different drafts and where is that bit where I wrote where they did this and then I cut it. What's your approach?
Catherine, you know I am the worst.
Answer the question.
I am the absolute worst. This is why I now keep it all in the journal.
It's the journal. Yeah.
Although having said that, you know, I don't copy and paste images and stuff. So I do have like heaps of folders of images and things like that. I'm much better now at naming files so if I do download maps, say from State Library or articles from Trove, I'm much better now at naming them.
Yeah.
You know, the date and what they're about, because I remember going back through looking for things that I'd had before. But now I always have that list of
websites that I've been, if it's really useful, a little bit of text, I copy and paste it, and then I can do a word search in the document as well.
Yeah. The worst thing to ever name something, I think, is like a date or it's just, why would I do that?
But, you know, I really seriously considered doing something properly like Evernote or, you know, going back or Scrivener for this one. To try it again, because I think the only time to do things like that is at the start of a project. But I just, it doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
It has to do so much thinking about that.
Yeah.
And I go in such a weird flow of jumping between things that it just works better for me all in that one big crash-worthy document.
Yeah.
I'm not the best person on this. Kelly Gardner is a good person on this. I think people who do their PhDs and stuff would also be like, that's a reason to go and do all that stuff, I reckon, to learn
it's
how
hard
to do it better.
Though, like, it's hard because sometimes people who are great researchers, and I'm not using those guys as examples at all, but who are great researchers, that is a heavy weight.
Oh yeah.
Sometimes as well, like, because it's interesting and in, you know, that.
You
sometimes make economic choices too. Like, you sometimes, you know, even in the context, I think, of the helpline, like the way a council works in terms of elected representatives and staff, like things like that would never happen. You know, like you sort of serve the story.
You absolutely serve the story. So at the end of this discussion that we've now had, 1950s Florida, can I convince you? Please do it.
No. Yeah. It feels very hard though. I think 1950s feels achievable. Florida feels a lot harder. Maybe I could go to Florida.
I think definitely you need to walk the ground. You need to make a movie list, the music list.
Yeah, I think I need to start doing, a movie list would be good. Images I think would really, really help.
Yeah.
But then it's also like I could really fictional, like I could take the concept and fictionalise it and do it in Australia. A bit like moving Elizabeth MacArthur to, I don't know, to, you know, Jamaica or something.
Yeah,
like how much are you sort of corrupting the thing?
Oh, my
God. But I do like the idea.
I'm so excited to know what this book is. I don't care. Just wait for everyone getting your feedback on the next one so you can just have time to start this now, please.
Well, I think I'm going to start an hour a day.
Perfect.
Waiting on edits. That sounds like an achievable thing.
We will check back in. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Mirandi Rewo to the First Time podcast. Mirandi Rewo is a Brisbane-based writer. She's the author of two crime novels, She Be Damned and A Necessary Murder, a novella, The Fish Girl, which won the 2017 Cesar Viva la Novella Prize and was shortlisted for the Stella Prize, and a new novel, Stone Sky, Gold Mountain, published by UQP. She has also been shortlisted for Overland's Neilma Sidney Short Story Prize, the Josephine Ulrich Short Story Prize, and the Luke Bittmead Bursary. Her work has appeared in various Australian literary journals. Rewo has a PhD in creative writing and literary studies from QUT. Mirandi Rewo, welcome to the First Time podcast.
Thank you for having me. I love this podcast.
Oh, we're so excited. We, of course, had planned to interview you in Brisbane at Avid, the amazing Avid bookstore, but, you know, little pandemic came along and ruined our plans. So I want to start with this. I want to start with this because you have just released your beautiful new book, Stone Sky, Gold Mountain. I think the release date was March 31st, Mirandi, just when, you know, the whole country went into lockdown. Tell me, when did you first realize like this was going to just be a shitstorm for your book?
Do you know what? I was actually in America at the beginning of March.
Oh, my goodness.
And I know. And when we left on the 1st, when we got there about the 1st of March, and it was still, I mean, it's so hard to even remember or think of now, but it was still like a very distant thing, this virus. You know, there was no way you were going to get it in America. As hard as it would have been in Australia at the time. But by about the 6th, then we heard that some LAX workers had caught it, and that's when we were first sort of like, oh. And then we got back around the 10th, and I think that was still a week or so before they started to quarantine people coming in from us. So it's still, but everything was moving so quickly each day. But what happened is we were in America, and it was about the time that they announced that some LAX workers had it, And it was starting to come out that actually it was just latent there, like it was going around the general public. And I said to Dave, my husband, I said, maybe my launch won't go ahead. And he was like, oh, that's ridiculous. I mean, that's just, you know, that's end of March. Of course it'll go ahead, you know. Anyway, and then, I mean, by the time we came home and then a week passed and then another week, every day there was, just, you know, it sort of chipped away. Like at first they were like, no, no, we'll still do it. And then it was like, oh, but we'll have to just have, and then it came down to, I think they were only allowed to have 20 people and we would have had to have them all like, you know, 2 meters apart from each other.
Oh my goodness.
And I think by that stage I realized I wouldn't have wanted my parents there for sure.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have wanted to put other people at risk. That was even before they put us all in lockdown, you know, or whatever. And then of course by the about 3 days before the date it was we realized you just couldn't do it. You just couldn't do it. Which is when I had my Zoom one.
And can I say, because that was the first event that I went to in this little thing, and it was so amazing. There were so many people there. How many were there in the end? Like,
120, I think, something like that. I think 177 registered, but obviously many people forgot. I think that's what happens too with these online things. You just wander off and forget about them. But it was just so supportive and so lovely. And I was really, I found it, I would never have ever have thought it would be so, but I found it so moving. And I think it was seeing everybody's faces, that there were people from South, you know, like yourself and other people that would never have been at my real, you know, launch at Avid.
Absolutely.
So it was just, and family that couldn't have, you know, couldn't make it because of the virus. It was just really beautiful. And I really, I do feel a bit lucky that I had the first one.
Well, you know. I think you set a very high standard. It was like the stage setting was amazing. You looked completely gorgeous, this gorgeous couch, and your lipstick matched the whatever was on the couch, and your reading was amazing. And yet, like you said, it was like a who's who of all these incredible writers who were there.
It was really great.
Really schmick. It was really, really very impressive. So that must have been a bit of a highlight. What have been the trickiest things?
I guess realizing, look, everybody's been so supportive. So thank you everyone for being so supportive, because I think they realize these books in this time that are being released, because obviously I did ask if it could be delayed or postponed, but, the books were already in, you know, warehouses stores, ready to go out. They were already in the back of shops. So, it was too late to postpone, and everybody's been so supportive. So, you know, I think if anything, people have, you know, really, helped out because they know it's such a difficult time. But I think the downside is knowing actually everybody's pretty distracted. And so if it is advertised or reviewed or whatever, people aren't really noticing that sort of thing. Mm. And, you know, and it's, I won't be able, I guess one big disappointment is I won't be able to see it at the moment anyway in bookshops on the shelf. You love seeing, you know, when you walk through a shopping centre or you walk through and, you know, your book's there on the shelf. It's so great. And I do wonder if maybe in the future, you know, when all the new books come out, you know, I was listening to somebody, might have been on your podcast or one of the podcasts, was saying that you only have that short kind of shelf life with a book. And then the next book comes out in the next month even. Like, I realised too, this is for a very short period before, rightly so, the focus goes to the next book that's come. But I guess, and I've been a bit worried that maybe it'll sort of sink into this pandemic hole. And also maybe by the time next year, when things hopefully go back to normal, I do wonder if it'll still be associated with that sort of pandemic time. Do you know what I mean?
That's interesting.
Because it was so prominent. You know, when you don't, you know, it was, you know, you sort of try to put those things behind you. But mostly it's been going really well. Like, I've had a lot of support and it's been fun. And,
How are you chatting to readers? You know, are you getting responses either on social media? Are you getting emails? Are you seeing things up on Instagram? What's happening in terms of reader response?
I've seen some lovely feedback on Instagram and Twitter. Friends and family are very supportive on Facebook. It's still early days, of course. I mean, a lot of people haven't had time to read.
Really early. And, you know, the post is going relatively slowly. So in terms of getting there.
And, no, but it's, yeah, the whole thing so far, like, you know, even I'd have to say even if we weren't in a pandemic, apart from not being in bookshops and not being out and about, like I can't do, you know, book clubs live, Zoom has really helped or Skyping's really helped. And podcasts and radio people have been really helpful. Like I just can't complain. It's been quite a good run considering.
That's great. And I know that other authors will find that reassuring as well.
Yeah.
Before we move on, lots of authors and writers have been talking about the fact that they just cannot seem to write at the moment. They're just kind of so scattered. I know it would have been promotional phase, and it is for you anyway. Have you found you're able to get any writing done at the moment?
No, none. No. Oh, I hope Aviva's not listening. No, I haven't. I have had quite a few sort of, I guess, questionnaires and yep. things to fill in, like you said, as part of the promotion for this. So that's kept me a bit busy. But apart from that, no, I've just been, you know, totally distracted and sort of just studying up on coronavirus things and been procrastinating. Like, yeah, I haven't even been reading probably because, yeah. you know, you'd think this would be a great time. I have done a tiny, tiny bit of research reading for my next novel.
Okay, nice.
Which is what I'd normally do, but probably a lot more than I am doing. But, yeah, no, the writing has been very scarce.
Which is okay.
But also I don't want to get – I did sign up for the Varuna thing for alumni, the residency, but you're in your own home.
Yes.
So I signed up for the first one, which I'm really excited about.
That's great.
That's the Charlotte Wood and Michael Robotham, so we get to sort of pick their brains.
Amazing.
Yeah, so that'll be really good. So I'm hoping because we're supposed to write for that, and because I probably have to take something to the table, I'm hoping that will get me sort of motivated and moving.
Excellent.
Because I also think, you know, you don't want to get to this end of the 6 months and think, oh my God, I should have done all that reading and writing then.
I know.
You know, so hopefully I pick myself up and get myself working.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go backwards in time now. Do mm-hmm. you remember, Mirandi, the first time you ever saw your words in print?
I do. I guess, sorry, what first comes to my mind was my first novel when I got it in from the Legend Press in UK.
Yeah.
And that was totally thrilling. I would have to say the first time I saw it in print must have been online, maybe a short story. And I remember with even being shortlisted, seeing your book or your story, so your own writing, even the short story was just so thrilling. I'd say my first sort of thrill as a writer came from short fiction, that first sort of taste of being published. But yes, I remember getting the novels from UK and they were just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful cover. Mm.
So, you know, everyone we speak to has a very different kind of path to publication. Yours, I feel, is particularly different in that your first novel was published in the UK first and under a pseudonym, or, well, that's not the name that you're published in Australia now.
That's right.
Tell us the story of how that all happened.
Oh, okay. So I was writing, so that was crime fiction when originally I wanted to be a crime writer. And I wrote that novel as part of my PhD. And what happened
is She Be Damned.
She Be Damned.
Yep.
But before that, I'd written a murder mystery set in Indonesia, and that was part of a master's. But that was never published. But what happened is the publisher, your publisher in UK,
yes,
Legend. I remember Legend. They brought us out at the same time. That's right. I was very pleased. Yeah. It's on writer on the list. Anyway, they had a competition. So Legend Press used to have a competition once a year, and it was international, and it was your first manuscript, and if it won, they would publish it. And it was named after a young man who was one of their first writers, and he died. So it was like a you know, bursary from the family. And the Indonesian novel was shortlisted. But okay. The good thing is, that's why I always say to people, like, enter things. Because yes. The good thing, once, you know, I'd been shortlisted, then, of course, I was in touch with the editor, the commissioning editor. So you've already got this rapport. You're not going through the slush pile, you know. So then I could email her. So I emailed her a bit later and I said, look, and they also, I don't know if you know, Kate, ours were the first historical fictions with them as well, because before them they didn't take historical fiction. And even on their website it said, don't offer us historical fiction, we don't take it.
Oh,
so
wow.
I sent her a letter and I said, an email, and I said, do you, you know, I've got this other manuscript if you'd like to look at it, but it's, and I didn't say the word historical, I was like, it's set in the Victorian period.
Nice.
And I just fluffed through it. And then, so she said, well, luckily we're starting to look at historical. And then, a few weeks later, it was only like 3 weeks later, they gave me a contract, which was really thrilling. You know, when you first get that contract and you don't even sleep, it's just so thrilling. That's what it was like.
That's incredible. So what year was this, Mirandy? When was this happening?
That must have been, I think that was 2016 and it came out in 2017.
And since then you've got another one with them as well in that series?
I've got two others with them
in that three. Series.
Yeah.
And was it your decision then to publish under a different name to what you would publish here, or was that publisher decision?
You know what it was they just said, you know, what name do you want to use? And I said, well, so Chia, T-J-I-A, is my father's actual Chinese name, spelt okay. The Dutch way, because the Dutch were in Indonesia at the time, you know, of the family. And he's Chinese but was born in Indonesia. So Chia is his Chinese name. Riwu is his Indonesian name.
Okay.
And, yeah, so I said to them, oh, it can be Mirandy Riwu or maybe MJ Chia, which, and then we thought, well, that sounded a bit crimey, you know, the MJ, definitely. You know, just looks a bit different. So that's what we went with. And then meanwhile, of course, you know, like my PhD and my, I guess my short fiction, which is literary fiction, was just, I sort of automatically put it around as Mirandy Riwu, because that's my actual name. And so that's how it sort of happened, which was actually worked really well. Because I think crime readers, I know as a crime reader, or if you like literary fiction, either way, you get irritated if you pick up your favorite crime writer, say, and then you realize it's not like one of like the other ones, and it's not even, say, a crime fiction. Like, that's irritating. So I think it's really best for readers and everyone if with the different names.
So how do you manage the practicalities of that in terms of social media presence or interviews, things like that? Like, I'm interested in how that works for you.
Well, I guess I just, you know, people approach me via whichever publisher it might be. My presence as a crime writer is certainly nothing compared to like my presence as Mirandy Riwu. So it's like I think I said it on the Garrett, I'm no Emma Viskic.
Not yet.
No Jane Harper. So, but just lately, I think, is it Lit Hub in America? Lit Hub, they have Crime Reads, which is a part of their Lit Hub. And they approached me to do a piece just on courtesans, because my character's a courtesan and in Victorian London. And so I think that was just a couple of weeks ago I sent that off to them. So
fantastic.
And that'll be in Crime Reads. So I guess I just do whatever I'm told.
Lovely. I love it. You also write a lot of short fiction. Can you manage, like, can you be writing on multiple projects at the same time, or do you have to kind of plan it out through the year? I'm working on something in the Heloise Chansey series. I'm working on this literary, you know, fiction, short fiction. I'm working on a big project. How do you manage it all?
No, I do. I think I would divide it up. Like, even at the moment, I'm thinking of wanting to write a couple of short stories for some competitions coming up. And that means I will set aside time just for that. So I think, like, what happened is last year, or maybe the year before last, I was doing some of Stone Sky, but then I had to quickly write and finish the third Heloise novel. And then instead of going back to Stone Sky, Aviva was absolutely horrified. But I went, I really wanted to enter the Griffith novella competition because I had an idea for a character for, or a novella. So I really wanted to enter that. So I worked on that for however many months. And then I went back to Stone Sky.
Wow.
So okay. I do it in kind of chunks. I don't think I could sort of interweave them actually. Yeah, and because you know how you've got to be really sort of in it.
Deep
to,
in it.
Yeah, so.
So does that mean that you have it planned out in advance, say, for the next year? I am looking at your whiteboard behind you.
Yeah, that's right. Do I have it planned out? I will have, yeah, I'll have a few plans around the place. Like, so I guess maybe even while I'm working on Stone Sky, because I've got all, just say as an example, I had my research done, I'd had my ideas all jotted down, I'd started to put it together. I think I'd written a lot of Liars sections, which is when I went off to do the Heloise novel. Now, the Heloise, so the crime fictions, you can't see the whiteboard, but there's another whiteboard there that I've actually, like, it's the crime fiction's heavily plotted out, like,
yeah, heavily, wow.
Like per kind of 5,000 word kind of increments. So, and then even the 5,000s, I'll even do it in 1,000 words within the 5,000 words, you know, just so you know what you're working on the next day. You know, I had to write this thing about writer's block, but I think if you know where you're going, I think it was, who was it? Hemingway. I think he said to not to finish off for the day, like leave some for the next morning so you can get started again. I think that's brilliant. Really, really handy. Like at the moment I'm taking notes and getting all my research together for my next novel. So I do know with each of them, and like I was saying, so when I'm writing Stone Sky, then maybe I was already starting to think of Anna the Javanese, which is the novella. Like I was already starting to collect notes for that. So I always make sure I've got something to go on. And maybe it helps that it's historical fiction because then I have to do the research and the thinking. I'm not just winging it.
Yep. Yeah, so many questions. I feel like I could just, I want to dive in there and look at your study. Mirandy, in terms of, you said before in Stone Sky, you had Liu's story written down and then you jumped into something else. Did you write each of the perspectives separately and then weave them together? Okay.
No, and I wouldn't usually do that at all.
Yeah.
That's not true. In the crime fiction, in the last one, I think I had them, I have my protagonist and her mother, and I had them having different mysteries each, so they could be done sort of separately. No, Laya, I wouldn't normally do that, but I happened to be in Shanghai in a residency, and his story, because a lot of it is not intertwined with the girls, his story, I thought, to build the tension, to build, you know, and to build up to, you know, and he, you know, as you know, he's slowly sort of changing, to build that, to keep that momentum up, I couldn't go in and out of him. I felt I needed to write him so his character was building, you know, his emotions and his mental sort of presence was building with the story. So that's why I on purpose wrote his in one go, and then I had to tinker with it anyway because then it had to match the girls anyway later. But the girls was, and then after that, then I intertwined it all as I wrote. I did write, you know, I did write Ying, then Miriam, Laya, you know, and I did write it like that.
You've just described how you have that very clear plotting for your crime series.
Yeah.
Do you have something similar where you're doing the literary fiction historical novels?
Yeah, I would have something. I even have it sort of mapped out like that for short stories.
You are amazing.
I just like, so there's a lot that goes into, I guess, my work before I even start writing. So, you know, and I'll take notes of even sentences or something they might say or see or something that might occur to them and then build it in. But then I need to know where it's going to go in the story. So I do quite a bit of planning. Now, that's not to say things don't change because a lot of the time, I would say most of the time, you know, you've got your plan, but things do change or what you thought you were going to put in doesn't fit or it's, you know, it evolves in some way. So, but I would say structurally, I definitely know where I'm going. I would usually know the end. I would usually know what I'm working towards. Yeah.
In terms of your research, which I know is incredibly in depth, you talked about it a little bit in your launch for Stone Sky. Do you have to have the majority of that down before you move on to that next planning stage, or are you doing it simultaneously?
Yeah, usually, like say for Heloise, the first one, I did a year of research first, and that was historical fiction, that was contemporary, but also, you know, written at the time, and of course, actual history, you know, primary sources, that sort of thing. But you'd even watch things on TV. I mean, you know, I went to London a couple of times. I went to all the museums and you're seeing the costumes. And I mean, there's all that sort of, and also you look at what I really liked was looking at, psychology or philosophy, you know, for different ways that your characters or definitely like, say, how to, sort of feminist texts or post-colonial texts, you know, to sort of inform how I want the book to, you know, present itself. And that took a year before I put pen to paper on the... And I remember I had a book on how to... it was a book on... It was kind of a airy-fairy book on creativity. And the woman in it said... write your biggest fears, you know, as a writer, you know, for this creative process, you know. And so I wrote something like, I think I wrote, I will never be able to write a historical novel, you know. And that was at the beginning. And that was at when we were away, like it was at the beach. And then a year later, it was literally a year later, I found the book and opened and read that, and I'd just finished writing the novel. so I did do it. But that's how much doubt you do have in the beginning, even with all the research, because there's so much research that obviously, and it does not go in your book. And I think people find that disappointing. You know, people always come to you with ideas or blah, 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 but you can't put all of it in. I mean, it's all interesting, but you can't put all of it in, which I think is maybe a mistake historians make when they try to write fiction, is trying to cram it all in. What was the question again, Kate?
No, you answered it brilliantly. What I want to ask now is, how are you recording all of that research? Do you have documents? Do you have notebooks? How do you do it?
All of it. So it probably did start in notebooks or notes in my phone, because a lot of the time you know you have these ideas, but you know you're not near your notebook or you're out or whatever. So a lot on my phone, a lot in a notebook, and then I collate it for what I want to use. So even at the moment, or as an example, so for Stone Sky, I have a Word document. So that was after all the note taking and everything. I have a Word document, and it has notes on setting, because I went to Maytown, and so I've put all that in. I've got notes on each character. So, you know, when I think of some reaction they might have or what they're wearing or whatever, or maybe their dislikes, likes, whatever, that'll go in there. I have a section on Maytown itself, a section on what you would find in a store at the time. You know, Chinese racism, you know, so yeah, I sort of then make it into sections in a Word doc. And then the good thing is, I was saying this to a couple of writer friends last night, the good thing is then too, when you put them in your book, you can cross them out too.
Nice.
You know, you're just like, oh, I've covered that, you know, like, yeah.
It really strikes me the way you're describing it, and also the experience of reading Stone Sky. I did a Q&A session with Charlotte Wood last week, terrific session on Zoom, and I think Susan Francis actually asked about establishing setting really well. And Charlotte described... what she described as thick description, an anthropological term, where you've just got such a sense of the kind of the place, the sensory experience of the place, that you can reach into all of those details. And reading your work, The Fish Girl is the same. It's such a visceral experience. It is, you know, you really feel like in Stone Sky, I felt like I had the humbug stuck in my teeth. And I, you know, I felt like I could smell Maytown and all of those things. Like, it's just beautifully detailed. So it's incredible to go behind the scenes and realize how you're doing that as well.
Yeah. I think too, as a people use, you know, if they ever said to me, you know, oh, you know, you write setting really well. And I'd be like, really? Because originally, or even now, I think maybe the hardest thing to write is setting. I find it really hard work, which might account for how much attention I give it, because I actually find it. I know some people love it. I mean, some people can just, you know, like nature writing, they just love it and they can do it. But I mean, luckily when we went to Maytown, it was with my husband, and he's sort of a forestry geology fellow. So he knew all the trees and the birds and the rock formations and everything, which I know nothing about. So that was super handy.
That's really handy.
Oh, look.
Excellent choice on a partner.
I know. And then, but even when I gave it to him to check those parts, you know, and I think I might have, just as an example, I had something like a grove of bloodwoods, or maybe it was iron woods. And he goes, no, they don't come in a grove. And then, you know, and then another one, I think it was bloodwoods, is never bloodwoods. It's always just bloodwood for multiple, you know. But so I learnt things too.
And they are those details, don't you think, Miranda? Like, you know, most of the people reading would never even pick that up, but it's the specificity that you know as well. It's the naming of things, you know, like so many writers say that all the time. You've got to name the thing, make it the bloodwood
instead of
the tree. Like, that's what those details are brilliant for.
I remember maybe I'd read something by Marquez, and he was saying, you know, that scene where it's all the birds, but he doesn't say flock of birds. He says something like, there were 83 birds or whatever, you know, whatever it was. And I was just like, oh, I really liked that. But people do notice if you get something wrong. And I know, because my mum, it really throws them. Then they don't like the rest of the book, you know.
No, that's it.
Then they're out.
Well, they're taken out of the dream, aren't they?
Yeah, so.
Miranda, tell me, I watched your TEDx presentation for QUT, which is fantastic. And you talk about the feeling of outrage that led you to write The Fish Girl, which I know you've spoken about in other interviews as well. Was there a feeling of outrage that led to Stone Sky? Where did the concept first come from?
I guess the concept first was because I was writing about a Chinese character or a Eurasian character in Victorian London, and I did want to bring my writing back to Australia, I guess. So I wanted to look in maybe to the first Chinese here. And some of the earlier ones are the ones in the gold rush. So that's kind of where it started. And I did want to write, I've always been interested in those relationships from the 1800s between, say, a Chinese man and a white woman here. Like, how did they overcome, say, racism or, you know, just their own differences? Or maybe sometimes they didn't. Maybe their love affair wasn't allowed to go ahead, you know. So that's always been something of interest to me anyway, probably because I'm Eurasian. But then when I looked more into it, I realised there were sort of more serious themes, especially when I was looking into North Queensland and the gold rush. The absolute sort of casual attitude to the violence and, I guess, you know, what happened to the Aboriginal people up north. So, you know, you do become kind of outraged that people don't know about it. It's there to be found in primary sources and in historical work, but nobody reads it nowadays necessarily, and it's not necessarily taught. And then there's other historical books written, but they're sort of more in this sort of cowboy kind of attitude. And then I guess what I was saying to somebody the other day, I think what it is for me, it's trying to look at just how ridiculous racism is. Like, that really, I guess that outrages me a bit, is just how ridiculous it is. Oh, you know, my son, he's part Asian, obviously, but quite dark. And at school, his best mates were African kids. And the racism, the casual race, or not even casual, just from teachers or bus drivers, just the silly things they'd say, or you know, not let them on, probably going by how they look, you know. So I guess, yeah, I have sensed maybe racism has been getting worse than I remember it as a kid. So I guess I just, outrage at those sort of things do colour some of the things in my novel, just how far maybe some things haven't moved on.
I really liked you say in that presentation too that you like to loop the ideas of the past, you know, back into the present or vice versa. And I think it is that incredible contemporary kind of gaze that you can have, that you allow your readers to have on that historical moment, which is so important for our engagement as readers.
Yeah.
But then you've got that technical difficulty of getting the worldview right and authentic for your characters too. How do you manage that? Like, do you just do that instinctively now, or is there particular strategies you put in place to get that worldview of your characters at the time right?
I think that would come from reading, especially, say, see, I want to say fiction from the time, but even the fiction written during, say, the 1800s is written by certain people, you know, from a certain class and a certain cultural background. But I guess you can get a feel for it in that way. I think there are, you know, so obviously some attitudes have changed, but some I think are the same. I think, you know, I noticed when I was doing my research for Heloise, for the crime fiction, you know, most people, or no, not most people, but a lot of people did live in sin, or they did, you know, like just get on with life like maybe we do now. But because everything's sort of sifted through that middle class or higher kind of point of view, or and it's shamed, then we see it differently. So I guess what I try to do is, but there, you know, there are good sources for working class or labour class crime resources, you know, and interviews with those people that you can go by and get a real feel for maybe a more a lower class sort of feeling for life. I guess for the Chinese characters, all I wanted to do is, instead of, you know, we all know about the Chinese coming here in the gold rush, but we're thinking in big groups, you know, like we're thinking of like a herd. We're not thinking of individuals. And I know, and I've heard of some individual stories about, obviously, that I read or met people from the period. I didn't meet anyone from the period. I met somebody's great-grandchild from the period and heard the stories. And so I guess I felt then I had license to explore my character stories, because there just would have been so many people. I mean, there are up to 20,000 Chinese just in Palmer River area. That's a lot of stories. That's a lot of individual stories, you know, to sort of look into. So who's to say mine isn't true?
I know you mentioned before about those stories, you know, and how they're taught. And just in my role as a history teacher and English teacher, I've often done that kind of gold rush story and Chinese on the goldfields. Mm-hmm. And all I could think when I finished the book was, my goodness, I hope that this book goes on curriculums everywhere, because I think it does. It just stops that, what I think happens all the time, which is that total othering, both from the historical perspective, which is, oh, that's back then, so they're just so unlike me, and also what tends to happen with this very Western approach to it when we're teaching it here. So,
yeah, well, the other thing that has occurred to me too was, you know, like I said, there were 20,000. I mean, a lot of them went back, but I do actually really wonder how different Queensland or North Queensland would look if the White Australia policy hadn't been introduced, you know. That leaves me curious, because even when I was in Palmer River at the local tavern on the way in, they had little bags of those, you know, those salty plums that are in the novel, had these little individually wrapped packets. And I was like, oh, my God, that's amazing. And the girl was sort of like, oh, everyone's got them. And I'm like, no, not everyone has these, you know. And I really think maybe it's a leftover from that period, you know, because they had Chinese shopkeepers there for many years, you know.
You were shortlisted for the Stella Prize for The Fish Girl. And, in fact, I recall being there that night and meeting you that night when at the shortlist. What did being shortlisted mean for you?
I think as you can imagine, it meant everything. Like, it really, you know, we were talking about it earlier, anybody who's a writer knows that sort of insecurity, you know, of maybe your work's shit. Maybe it's no good. And certainly certain fiction doesn't, you know, we don't get a lot of readers as such, you know, you're not like a bestseller. So I guess the nice thing about being shortlisted, especially for the Stella, which is just such a great prize, is just that affirmation that maybe you can write. But I'm also, I guess, also being part of the community. I mean, that was really nice to be part of, you know, that just that women's writing sort of community is a cozy place to be. Yeah, and it's just, anyway, Stella's so wonderful too. I mean, they really look after their shortlistees and their winner and everything and their writers and, you know, and they did, they made a, you know, you have that poster and your Stella bag and, yeah. And I mean, they just do such a great job. I just love them.
And the Fish Girl then, you know, I did, I don't know, I don't know figures, I don't know anything like that, but I imagine that it really pushed it out there into a lot of people's hands. Absolutely. That might not normally have seen it.
Absolutely. I think actually the Stella, I think, might have even had to contact the publisher to say, you might want to
print some more.
Yeah, print some more, yeah. So
you said before that you always encourage other writers to enter things, and you've been published widely in literary journals. You've also been prose editor at Peril Magazine. How important are literary journals in Australia to help get writers off the ground?
They're really, really important, obviously. We're just for somewhere to showcase your work, and it really, I think it really does make a difference on your bio or profile to have, oh, and, you know, I've been in, you know, blah, 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 and blah, 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 and blah, 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 you know, and it's thrilling anyway. I mean, and they're all different types of journals. You know, you've got to know what they usually publish, no matter who you are. You know, they mightn't want the story, but I think they're very important. But I think a problem that was pointed out to me years ago is a lot of writers don't buy them.
Yeah.
Like, they want to be published in them, but they don't buy them. And I know we can't subscribe to every journal. And of course, some of them are in libraries anyway, but we can't, but maybe if you, you know, if you are a writer, subscribe to one or two just to support, you know, who you want to be published by, you know, and definitely read what they're putting out. But I think they're very important. I think things lately were a bit scary even before the pandemic. So, yeah, so I hope they see their way through, because I think they're really important to the literary scene, actually.
Yeah, and that's great advice about supporting them back as writers. There's some great advice that you mentioned in one of the Q&As that I read that you received from a Varuna judge during one of the publishing introduction
projects.
Oh, I think
it was Carolyn Majors.
Yeah. To treat your writing as a craft.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know what happened is I'll tell the truth. I entered that publisher introduction thing. Yeah. They used to, PIP thing, they used to do it for Una. So this must be in about 2016. And I entered it. And I used to be in a PhD office with Laura Elvery.
Yeah.
Anyway, I entered it. Anyway, and then it wasn't accepted, obviously. And the feedback all came in. And it was just general feedback to everyone. And I think Carol Majors was, oh, no. I think first she wrote something like, I don't know whether it was her or another one, but they wrote, you know, you read the synopsis and you think, this sounds really interesting. And then you start to read it and the writing is pedestrian. And I was like, oh. And I said to Laura, oh, my God, they're talking about my book.
Oh,
and she's like, oh, yeah, it's all about humor, Eddie.
That is such harsh criticism.
But I don't know if that was Carol Major. But Carol Majors said that she said, please, you know, like, it's, you know, musicians don't just sit down at the piano and artists don't just, you know, they're not Van Gogh straight away. Like, they learn their craft. And please, you know, writers learn, it's a craft. And it's true. Like, it took me many years of pedestrian writing to learn, you know. Like, I think that's really important to put, obviously some writers are published on their first work. Some, I think most probably aren't. And good on them. But I think for most people, maybe learn your craft. Yeah.
What
be patient and persevere. Persevere. Be patient and persevere.
That's excellent advice. What does your daily practice look like now, Mirandy? Are you writing full time or you know, full-time as any of us can put pen to paper. Do you have a mentor?
Do you mean outside pandemic times?
Outside pandemic times, yeah. Normally, okay, so in the normal world.
So what I, this is what I love to do. This is what I will do if I'm working. I like to, so, you know, the kids, you drop them off. I come home, I procrastinate for a while. Might, you know, go to the gym, whatever. Then I'll do some writing. And what I like to do is 500 words. I don't really like to let myself go until I've done my 500 words. And then, or and first, of course, you're looking at your 500 words from the day before. So you're doing some editing there, you're fixing that up, and then you're sort of rolling into your next 500 words. And then ideally what I like is to do a bit of reading then to do with that project or maybe the next project or whatever, but to not like just, you know, the latest novel,
yep,
but reading to do with that project. And then that'll either go only to school pickup or maybe a bit later, depending on like how much work I've got to do. So that's, and if I'm writing a book, like I'm really ensconced in it, then I really like to work even on a Sunday, like even on the weekends, I'll just keep up that 500 words, because, and especially if you've got a deadline, it just makes it more doable. It's like, I think Thea Astley said once, like if you do your page a day by the end of the year or even 6 months, you've got a book, you know. So, well, that's Thea Astley.
I love it. Excellent work. Before I let you go, one of the other things that I really loved in your TEDx talk is that you talked about looking forward and what future generations will write about us.
Us, yeah.
Are there ways in which you're recording what's happening now, or what do you think those future generations are going to write about us, Mirandy?
Well, I guess what you would hope is, so I guess the my short fiction is usually, you know, it's contemporary, it's not historical fiction. So, and like I said, what I like to look at, you know, like I think a story I have in ABR is about, it actually was based on my son, and that's sort of racism against sort of that skater looking, skater sort of culturally diverse looking kid. What I would hope is that things have moved on, you know, like say with domestic violence or human trafficking of women and, you know, sexual exploitation and racism, you would hope that we've moved on and that people aren't still writing a book 150 years later that they can tie to their present, you know, like I've been doing with ours. So I guess that's what I would hope. And I think it's possible. I think it's possible. I think, you know, but that's what I would hope, that they're not, you know, that they're looking at now as a jumping stone to their time, maybe.
You've already given us some great advice. Are there any other bits of advice you wanted to give to debut writers or writers out there at the moment?
No, usually, which I shouted before, usually my one key piece of advice is to persevere. I would never have known I could be so dogged about something. Honestly, before I was wanted to be an author, I would have never have thought I could be so dogged. So that would be my one advice to would-be writers, is to keep on learning your craft and just keep on persevering and keep on trying.
We always ask for a recommendation of a debut book, any time, any genre. Oh, Mirandy's jumping up. She's got something to show me immediately.
No, I do. It's not new, but it is her debut work. And you might have had it before. I don't think you have, but you might have had it before. But I just like it because she was on the Stella shortlist with me, but she also just got shortlisted for the International Booker Prize, which is amazing. And it's a beautiful, beautiful book. So it's that Shakufa Azar's The Enlightenment of the Green Gage Tree. Amazing. It's just a really beautiful book. And it's beautifully written. It's moving. She's great. And, I mean, International Booker.
That's huge. Fantastic.
Huge. So, and that's her debut book, and it's, you know, been translated. So I think that's really, really amazing.
An excellent recommendation. We will add it in. Mirandy, it has been an utter delight to speak with you. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Lovely. It's been fun. So fun. Thank you, Kate.
Mirandy Ariwo, your first time quick five, and you're allowed to pass on any question, remember.
Okay.
For your first time, agented or unagented?
Unagented.
Advance or no advance?
Advance.
Now, this question, overseas territories or just Australia and New Zealand? We're going to have to take this in two parts. Were your first books published by Legend Press only sold first in the UK?
No, they also were here with Pantera Press.
That's right. Excellent. And then what about The Fish Girl?
Fish Girl and Stone Sky Gold Mountain are still just here.
Okay. At this moment. Festival invites or no festival invites?
Lots of festival invites, but they've all been cancelled.
Hopefully some of them go online. And do you know how many copies of your first book you've sold?
Oh, Kate, I have no idea, sorry. But I'm not a huge seller, so it's not anything to write home about.
You just get those letters and pop them in the filing cabinet. Thank you for playing, Mirandy.
Thank you.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.